is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the sunny but cold suburbs of Chicago. I really appreciate you joining me today on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit Spingola.com. You will see the names of every guest that I've had on the program since October 23rd, 2010, as well as links to their websites. You will also see guests that I already have lined up for future programs. Just visit the website and click on the radio schedule button. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.info, a site that one of our wonderful, very talented listeners created. You will find some very good files and links there. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour when we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. Our guest today is James Perloff. That is P-E-R-L-O-F-F. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior. It is available at Amazon. He is also the author of The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The American Decline. He has some other books also. Today we are going to talk about something that happened a few decades back. Jim, are you with us?
Sure am. Thank you.
Oh, great. Very, very good. Okay, you have a very timely topic today, and it's something that we should all be thinking about in a couple of days. And it really got America into World War II.
Yes, and that's, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor, and December 7th coming up in a couple of days is what is known as Pearl Harbor Day. And we're going to talk today about some of the things that are going on behind the scenes. And I know that a lot of younger listeners, Deanna, who are involved in, say, the 911 truth movement, are familiar with more recent false flags, but they may not be familiar with this one. And so we're going to go over all the details that are relevant to Pearl Harbor today.
Okay, sounds great.
And we're going to talk a little bit about what was going on in World War II and the Illuminati goal of knocking the Japanese aside, really to clear the way for communism in Asia. We're also going to talk about Franklin D. Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's attempts to provoke Japan into war, his decision to base the fleet in Pearl Harbor against all military advice. We'll also talk about Washington's foreknowledge of the attack, and finally we'll talk about the investigations that occurred post-attack that whitewashed Washington and put the blame on the U.S. military.
Okay. And there were certainly a lot of corruption and a lot of intentions in Washington, and they were plotting it for several months beforehand, or several years, actually.
Yes, this was a growing objective. And let me just start out by talking a little bit about World War II and what the Illuminati were aiming at. In World War II, they had three principal objectives, which are actually extensions of their motives in World War I. The first of the three is world government, and which is pretty obvious. You see the League of Nations coming out of World War I, and of course the stronger UN out of World War II, designed by the same forces. And some would say if we ever had a World War III, we'd have an all-powerful world government. The second was Zionism. I'm sure many of your listeners know that out of World War I in 1917 came the Balfour Declaration, by which Britain pledged to the Zionists to establish a national homeland in Palestine for Jews, even though Britain had no authority or presence historically in Palestine. That's why they invaded it. That's why you had Lawrence of Arabia, although he did not know what the plot that he was a part of. But, of course, invading Palestine had no relevance to winning World War One. But in World War Two, of course, you had the outcome of the State of Israel itself in 1948. And the third objective related to communism in 1917, the same year as the Balfour Declaration, you had the so-called Russian Revolution. The Tsar abdicated. And in World War Two, you had communism extending itself from Russia to all of Eastern Europe and into Asia. And it's this latter, the extension of communism, where Pearl Harbor and Japan come into play.
Indeed. And they always have such other rationalizations for doing what they do. And they use the media to get the population, the American population, all revved up to go to war and kill people that really has nothing whatsoever to do with anything that they've done to us. And as you mentioned before, this is a false flag, and we can certainly make some comparisons to the current false flags that are going on.
Right. I'd like to start with sort of a lateral comparison to what was going on in World War II in Europe to start with. In World War II, we're told, officially began September the 1st, 1939, when after Germany invaded Poland, Britain and France declared war on Germany, and we're supposed to believe that the France and Britain cared so much about the national sovereignty of Poland that they were willing to lay down the lives of their sons to preserve the precious sovereignty of Poland. But here's the thing. In September of 1939, Stalin's Soviet Red Army also invaded Poland. And what was the British and French reaction to that? Nothing. It was yawn. It was ho-hum. And how could that be? You know, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. If you're declaring war on Germany because you're concerned about Poland's sovereignty, they should have declared war on the Soviet Union too, but they did not. And of course, Uncle Joe soon became the recipient of convoys of aid from Britain. But even at the end of the war, Deanna, we had this same contradiction. At the end of the war, Poland lost its sovereignty. It was occupied by Soviet tanks. Stalin set up a puppet regime, and who cared? Did Britain or France or America care? And the answer is no. It was like, who cares about Poland's sovereignty? Well, wait a minute. We just fought a war where 60 million people died, and it was allegedly begun over the concern over Poland's sovereignty. Now when the war is over, nobody cares that Poland has lost that sovereignty. But as we're going to see, there is a analogy to this hypocrisy taking place over in the Far East. What we were told was, in the 1930s, Japan sent its troops into Manchuria, which is commonly perceived as the northernmost portion of China, even though the Manchurians did not consider themselves Chinese. We were told this is part of Japan's plan for world conquest. But here's what Americans were not told. They were not told that before Japan sent its troops into Manchuria, the Soviet Union, Stalin's Red Army, had entered Outer Mongolia in the northwestern province of China called Xinjiang. And, of course, communism had engulfed all of the Soviet Union, not just Russia, but there was Belarus, also called White Russia, the Ukraine, Georgia, Turkestan, and all the little republics that made it to the Soviet Union. Next on the Illuminati agenda was Asia. And the Soviets had moved into, as I said, Outer Mongolia and Xinjiang. And I don't want people just to think I'm making this up, so I'd like to give you a quote. I know we have time before the break, but this is from Dr. Anthony Kubik, who is chairman of the Political Science Department at University of Dallas. In his book, How the Far East Was Lost, he wrote, quote, "It was apparent to Japanese statesmen that unless bastions of defense were built in Manchuria and Inner Mongolia, communism would spread through all of North China and threaten the security of Japan. To the Japanese, Manchuria was a national imperative, but the Department of State seemed not to regard Japan as a bulwark against Soviet expansion in North China. As a matter of fact, not one word of protest was sent by the Department of State to the Soviet Union, despite her absorption of Xinjiang and Outer Mongolia, while at the same time, Japan was censured for stationing troops in China." Unquote, Dr. Anthony Kubik. So you see this hypocrisy. It's okay for Stalin to invade Poland, but not Germany. It's okay for Stalin to invade China, but not Japan. This hypocrisy will carry forth through the war.
Indeed. All righty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes. James Perloff. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior. It's his current book, available at Amazon. And today he's talking about Pearl Harbor, what led up to it, making some comparisons to what happened in Europe. So please continue.
Right. Well, first of all, I just want to mention that the Japanese movement into Manchuria was based on very similar principles to ones that we've practiced. They were trying to stop the expansion of communism into the sphere of Asia. You might recall that, of course, in the 1960s, America sent troops all the way around the world to Vietnam because we felt that it was in our national self-interest to stop the spread of communism there. So imagine how much more so that was true for the Japanese, looking at the spread of Soviet troops just 300 miles across the Sea of Japan. One more comparison I might make would be the Monroe Doctrine, which was articulated in 1823, where the United States said we're not going to allow foreign powers into our hemisphere to interfere here or colonize. The Japanese were really deploying their own version of the Monroe Doctrine, which said we're not going to allow foreign powers, namely Stalin and the Soviet Union, into the Asian sphere. We're going to stop that from happening. That's not how it was represented to the American public. It was represented instead as world conquest on their part. And I also want to bring out that the Soviet Union was very interested in getting a war going between America and Japan. I'm going to quote from Benjamin Gitlow. He was a founding member of the United States Communist Party. He finally renounced the party and wrote a book in 1940 called I Confess. And here's what he wrote. Quote, when I was in Moscow, the attitude towards the United States in the event of war was discussed. Privately, it was the opinion of all Russian leaders to whom I spoke that the rivalry between the United States and Japan must break out into war between these two, unquote. Now, I'll also give you a quote from our own State Department. William C. Bullitt was ambassador to Moscow. He wrote in 1935, quote, it is the heartiest hope of the Soviet government that the United States will become involved in war with Japan. The Soviet Union would certainly attempt to avoid becoming an ally until Japan had been thoroughly defeated and would then merely use the opportunity to acquire Manchuria and Sovietize China, unquote. And of course, Deanna, we know that's exactly what happened. Stalin joined the war against the Japanese, but not until after we bombed Hiroshima with the atomic bomb. They ended the war in the Pacific 5 days before Japan surrendered, poured into China, and of course the outcome was the Sovietization of China, exactly as Bullitt predicted.
And of course, we allowed that. Hmm? You know, the United States accommodated that.
We accommodated by giving 600 shiploads of lend-lease to Stalin, which were promised at the Yalta Conference. In exchange for his ending the war, he also got control of North Korea as a reward for helping win, quote-unquote, win the Pacific War, which, of course, led to the Korean War and the current North Korean dictatorship. So the hypocrisy is absolutely amazing. It's amazing that these things aren't pointed out in history classrooms.
Yeah. Yeah, that's deliberate, I'm sure.
Well, just to carry on, we talked at the outset about Illuminati objectives for the Second World War, and it's very much a goal of Franklin D. Roosevelt to get us into that war despite his public protestations to the contrary. Now, he initially, as you, I'm sure you know, Deanna, he offered provocations to Germany, and actually he and Winston Churchill were old hands at false flags. Many of your listeners, I know, are familiar with how the Lusitania, the sinking of the Lusitania, was contrived in 1915 to inflame public opinion against Germany. At that time, Winston Churchill was head of the British Admiralty, and Franklin D. Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, which sends chills up your spine when you see these two men now as heads of state right at the outset of World War II. Now, President Roosevelt, to provoke Germany, he was looking for another Lusitania. He started sending, you know, of course, the destroyers to Britain, massive convoys of weapons being sent to Britain. We occupied Iceland, and we depth-charged U-boats, but the Germans weren't going for it this time. They, you know, we fell for it once, and we're not going to sink American shipping this time and get you involved because that cost us the First World War. I'm going to give you a quote here that you might not have heard, and I don't know if you've heard it before. It's from Admiral Dönitz, who is the commander, of course, mm-hmm. of the German submarine fleet. And this is what he said at Nuremberg. Quote, A 300-mile safety zone was granted to America by Germany when international law called for only a 3-mile zone. I suggested minefields at Halifax and around Iceland, but the Fuhrer rejected this because he wanted to avoid conflict with the United States. When American destroyers in the summer of 1941 were ordered to attack German submarines, I was forbidden to fight back. I was thus forced not to even attack British destroyers for fear there might be a mistake, unquote, Admiral Dönitz. So Churchill and Roosevelt are bending over backwards to provoke the Germans, but they're having none of it. They're not going to attack American shipping, so the attention now turns to Japan. And here's what his FDR's Interior Secretary, Harold Ickes, said. He said, quote, our best entrance into the war would be by way of Japan. And Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum of Naval Intelligence presented President Roosevelt with an 8-step plan of provocation against Japan, and it closed with these words, quote, if by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better, unquote. So that's that autumn, 1941, their meeting, the cabinet's meeting, and I'm going to quote now from the diary of the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and also Skull and Bones. Here's what he wrote, quote, we face the delicate question of the diplomatic fencing to be done so as to be sure Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, overt move. The question was how we should maneuver them into the position of firing the first shot, unquote. Henry Stimson, after meeting with President Roosevelt. And I'll also give you a quote from the British side. This is from Sir Oliver Littleton. He's a member of Churchill's cabinet, the Minister of Production. Here's what he said to the American Chamber of Congress in London, June the 20th, 1944. Quote, Japan was provoked into attacking the Americans at Pearl Harbor. It is a travesty on history to ever say America was forced into the war, unquote. Now, the provocations given Japan, Deanna, they involved incremental trade embargo measures, but the severest measures came in July of 1941, when suddenly the United States in Britain froze and seized all Japanese assets. We closed the Panama Canal to their shipping, and we instituted an all-out trade embargo, most critically oil. And, you know, no modern nation can survive without oil. And for a long time, Deanna, I pondered why it was that all these measures occurred in July of 1941. And you know what my conclusion is? Why that month that so many things were heaped upon Japan?
Why?
You know what happened on June the 22nd, 1941? Operation,
yes,
Barbarossa began.
Right.
And all the reports coming into Washington was that this is not just an invasion by Germany. It was the armies of Finland and Romania and Hungary and Italy and Croatia. And as I'm sure you know, many Belgians and Spaniards joined that invasion. This is an attempt to close out Stalin. And as hundreds of thousands of Russian troops were surrendering, and when they used to say when they surrendered in those early days, they'd say, Stalin kaput. Well, Stalin, of course, is terrified that his enemy, Japan, which has been fighting him in Manchuria, is now going to declare war. He's going to be caught in a vise. So now it is vitally important in July of 1941 to make sure that Japan does not attack Russia. And, of course, when you cut off oil, there's no chance they can get that. They can't get oil in Siberia, but they can get it in the south in the Dutch East Indies, where they have rich oil fields, and all the other raw materials that are being denied are in the south. This is why we have the Japanese moving south instead of attacking Russia. We'll pick this up after the break.
All right. Be right back in 3 minutes. Deanna, our guest today is James Perloff, and he's talking about Pearl Harbor. And so please continue.
Okay, well, I don't mean to suggest that the Japanese had a definite plan to join Operation Barbarossa, but war with Russia was not off the table. But there was definitely an Illuminati concern that the Soviet Union, which they had funded and created, was going to be squeezed in a two-front war. And what basically ensured Pearl Harbor was going to happen was November the 26th, 1941, Secretary of State Cordell Hull gave an ultimatum to the Japanese as we're negotiating with them. And the ultimatum, it contained several points, but basically it broke down to pull all your troops completely within Japan, take them out of Manchuria, out of China, which meant, of course, giving Stalin a free hand in Asia, and also to break their tripartite pact with Italy and Germany. And, of course, if anybody came along and told us we had to pull our troops within our borders and break our treaties with other countries, we wouldn't put up with it, and the Japanese did not either. They were facing economic strangulation. Even 75% of their food imports were cut off. Japan was heavily dependent on imports. So faced with this embargo, which is basically an act of war in itself, they decided they would rather, die fighting rather than die sitting down. And we should next talk about the bait that was given to the Japanese and the decision to base the fleet at Pearl Harbor, because that's very important. In late 1940, President Roosevelt ordered the fleet to be moved from the West Coast to Pearl Harbor. And the fleet commander at that time was Admiral J.O. Richardson, and he flew into a rage. Speaking of flying, he flew to Washington to speak to Roosevelt, and he gave the president a host of reasons why this was a terrible decision. If you take a look at a map of Pearl Harbor at the time, 1941, the ships were boxed in like sardines, you know, one ship next to another. Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, was approachable by potential attackers from 360 degrees of uninhabited ocean. It would be safe, of course, if it remained based on the west coast of the United States. You couldn't attack from the east or the north or the south. You'd have to attack from the west, and with all the commercial shipping you'd have to cross, you'd never be able to make a surprise attack. But there are other reasons that Richardson gave Roosevelt as well. We're going to have to supply the fleet across 2,000 ocean miles. Personnel would have to cross the Pacific if needed personnel changes. Pearl Harbor had very limited dry docks and oil storage. 37% of the Hawaiian population was of Japanese ancestry, which made it ideal for Japanese espionage, if not sabotage, on the fleet. And also, he said, you know, basing the fleet away from the men's homes and families is going to be very destructive to morale. So he had more than half a dozen reasons to give Roosevelt to not put the fleet at Pearl Harbor. And the only reason Roosevelt could give, he told Richardson, it'll have a deterrent effect on the Japanese and will deter Japanese aggression. And, Deanna, do you think that Roosevelt was right about that?
No, obviously not.
As of December the 7th, 1941, everyone knew that Roosevelt was not right in thinking that putting the fleet at Pearl Harbor would deter Japanese aggression. But who shoulders the blame for this? Of course, it's going to be the military and not President Roosevelt, who will come out smelling like roses. I should mention that after this meeting with President Roosevelt, J.O. Richardson was fired as fleet commander, and he was given no reason, and he sent a message to the Navy Secretary, Frank Knox, and he said, Frank, you know, it's very unusual to be dismissed without being given a reason why. So Knox told him, President Roosevelt will meet with you, but President Roosevelt never did meet with him, and finally Knox simply told him, your meeting with the president made him unhappy. That was the word he used, unhappy. The next thing we should talk about is Washington's foreknowledge of the Pearl Harbor attack, and there were several means by which Washington knew that the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming. Japan communicated to its embassies throughout the world through a special code called the Purple Code. It was so complex it had to be enciphered by a machine and deciphered by a special machine. And the Japanese were confident no one could break that code. But we had very talented cryptanalysts in the War Department, and they succeeded in breaking the code. And Washington had its own purple machines. And we were decoding their diplomatic messages usually on a same-day basis, and every day those messages would be sent in a locked pouch to President Roosevelt, as well as Secretary of State Cordell Hull, the Army Chief of Staff, George Marshall. There were 9 people on the official list, but there's also one unofficial person. That was Harry Hopkins, who was really thought by many to be, frankly, Roosevelt's controller from Wall Street. He served basically the purposes of Bernard Baruch and the Wall Street set, and he got to see those messages as well. Well, what did these messages reveal, the purple decoding messages? They revealed that the Tokyo had told its Washington envoys that November 25th was a deadline for an agreement with the United States, and then it was pushed up to November the 29th, and the message said the deadline absolutely cannot be changed. After that, things are automatically going to happen, unquote. November the 30th, we decoded a message to the Berlin embassy to tell the Germans that, quote, the breaking out of war may come quicker than anyone dreams. We also decoded messages from Tokyo to the Consul General of Hawaii, ordering him to divide Pearl Harbor into five areas and start reporting the exact locations of warships and dock. Now, Deanna, there's nothing strange about spies watching ship movements, but when they want to know where each ship is located on a grid, it's obvious that the ships have been set up for destruction. But Washington felt that this was not important for Admiral Kimmel, who is the new Pacific Fleet commander in Hawaii, or General Short, the Army commander in Hawaii, to know. Also, 1 week before the attack, we decoded a message instructing the Japanese to start destroying all the secret documents. Why? Because once war broke out, they were going to lose their diplomatic immunity. Now, here's a real killer. There was a movie made in 1970 called Tora, 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 about Pearl Harbor, and it shows the Japanese ambassadors presenting Cordell Hull with the declaration of war, and Hull is just amazed that war has begun. He's absolutely shocked and surprised. But sure, in point of fact, he'd already read the decoded intercept of the declaration of war, as had President Roosevelt. It was no surprise at all. Well, in addition to the purple decodings, there were other means that Washington knew about the war and coming and the Pearl Harbor attack. One was this. Not all Japanese officers had a purple decoding machine. They had to have some means of communicating to these smaller officers that war was about to begin. And they gave them several potential messages. One was in the event of war with Russia, but the message of in case of war with the United States was Higashi no kaze ami, meaning east wind rain. East wind meant the United States, rain meant war. And on December the 4th, that message was transmitted to all those by Radio Tokyo. It was picked up by American intelligence. So everybody in the War and Navy departments knew for a fact on December the 4th that we were on the verge of war. I should add to this, though, in addition to these intercepts, there were many personal warnings given to the Roosevelt administration. In early 1941, our ambassador to Japan, Joseph Grew, sent this message to Washington, quote, the Peruvian minister has informed a member of my staff that he's heard from many sources, including a Japanese source, that in the event of trouble breaking out between the United States and Japan, the Japanese intended to make a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor with all their strength, unquote. Now, another warning came from Brigadier General Elliot Thorpe. He was a U.S. military observer in Java, which was under Dutch control at that time. The Dutch Army had also decoded a message from Tokyo to Bangkok forecasting the Pearl Harbor attack. Thorpe was so alarmed, he sent a total of four warnings to the War Department in Washington until he was told to send no further warnings concerning Pearl Harbor. And you can see Brigadier General Elliot Thorpe interviewed on YouTube in the BBC documentary made in the 1980s called Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor. In addition to this, the Dutch had their military attaché in Washington, Colonel F.G.L. Weigerman, personally warned George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, about Pearl Harbor before the attack. President Roosevelt was advised by J. Edgar Hoover of the attack. He got his information from Dusko Popov. Popov was a Yugoslavian double agent working for both the Nazis and us, but his true allegiance was to us. He learned from the Germans of the plan of the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. He informed Hoover. Hoover informed the president, and you can see Popov interviewed in that same documentary, Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor, as well as books on this subject. Senator Guy Gillette of Iowa was contacted by Kyiltsu Han. He was a Korean and was in contact with the Korean underground. And Han had gotten nowhere with the State Department, finally got an audience with Senator Gillette, who told him about the Pearl Harbor attack. Senator Gillette then had an audience with President Roosevelt, who said the matter will be looked into. And I'll give you a quote next from Congressman Martin Dies, who came into possession of a map revealing the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And here's what he wrote, quote, as soon as I received that document, I telephoned Secretary of State Cordell Hull and told him what I had. Secretary Hull directed me not to let anyone know about the map. Instead, he would call me as soon as he had talked to President Roosevelt. In about an hour, he telephoned to say he had talked to Roosevelt, and they agreed to be very serious if any information concerning this map reached the news services. I told him it was a grave responsibility to withhold such vital information from the public. The Secretary assured me that he and Roosevelt considered it essential to national defense, unquote, United States Congressman Martin Dies.
Amazing. Jim, we do have to take a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is James Perloff. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, available at Amazon. And today he's talking about Pearl Harbor. And it's very interesting, you mentioned about the decoding machines. And MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, was in the Philippines at the time. And it would have been very crucial for him to have one of those, but he didn't have one. And, of course, after Pearl Harbor, they attacked the Philippines and took out Clark Air Base. And a lot of the planes there.
And then proceeded the Bataan death march.
Yes.
Well, we were talking before, and I should mention that before this program is out, I'll list a number of resources people can go to find documentation of all these facts.
Okay.
But to continue with the foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, we've talked about the Purple Machines. We've talked about the radio message East Wind Rain, and we've talked about the personal warnings. Another method of knowing about Pearl Harbor came to light more recently, a little over a decade ago, with the book Day of Deceit by Robert Stinnett. He used the Freedom of Information Act, and he found something that no previous investigator of Pearl Harbor had known. It was so top secret. We not only cracked the diplomatic code, Purple Code, we'd also cracked Japan's naval codes, and were reading those messages as well. And it had long been assumed that as the Japanese fleet was approaching Pearl Harbor, maintained complete radio silence, but that is not the case. They had to communicate, and they observed discretion, but not complete silence. And the most important intercept was this one, Admiral Yamamoto, the Japanese First Air Fleet, November the 26th, 1941, quote, the task force keeping its movement strictly secret and maintaining close guard against submarines and aircraft shall advance into Hawaiian waters, and upon the very opening of hostilities shall attack the main force of the United States fleet and deal it a mortal blow. The first air raid is planned for the dawn of X day, exact date to be given by later order, unquote. Now I'd like to give you one more quote affirming this foreknowledge. This is from Helen Heyman. She was the daughter of Don Smith, who was director of the Red Cross's War Service before World War II. This is from the June 2nd, 2001 Washington Times. Shortly before the attack in 1941, President Roosevelt called him, my father, to the White House for a meeting concerning a top-secret matter. This meeting, the President advised my father that his intelligence staff had informed him of a pending attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. He anticipated many casualties and much loss. He instructed my father to send workers and supplies to a holding area. When he protested to the president, President Roosevelt told him the American people would never agree to end the war in Europe unless we were attacked within their own borders. He followed the orders of his president and spent many years contemplating this action, which he considered ethically and morally wrong. I do not know the Kimmel family, therefore would gain nothing by fabricating this situation. However, I do feel the time has come for this conspiracy to be exposed, and Admiral Kimmel vindicated of all charges. In this manner, perhaps both he and my father may rest in peace, unquote. Helen Heyman, daughter of Don Smith, director of the Red Cross's War Service. And before we talk about the Pearl Harbor investigations, the official investigations, I'd like to talk about what was going on the morning of December the 7th. The full declaration of war, a break in relations with the United States, had already been decoded in both the Navy and War Department. In the Navy Department, Admiral Stark, who was the Chief of Naval Operations, was shown the message. Junior officers begged him to notify Pearl Harbor because the Japanese had given their ambassador very specific instructions that the declaration of war must be delivered exactly at 1 p.m. Washington time. Now, the Japanese had a history of making surprise attacks coordinated with declarations of war. For example, they had attacked Port Arthur when they declared war on Russia in 1905. And 1 o'clock Washington time was just after dawn in Hawaii, and everybody understood this what this meant. But Admiral Stark would not notify Pearl Harbor, and later he said that his conscience was clear because all of his actions were directed by what he called a higher authority, and the only higher authority he had was President Roosevelt. But I particularly like to call attention to Chief of Staff George Marshall. Now, in the War Department, Colonel Rufus Bratton, he was head of the Far Eastern Section in the War Department, had seen the message, the full declaration of war, and he was told he could do nothing unless General Marshall, the Chief of Staff, arrived. So he tried reaching Marshall at home, and he was repeatedly told the general is out on a horseback ride. Well, this horseback ride lasted for 2.5 hours, and as we'll see in a moment, he was not out riding a horse at all. He finally came home and talked to Bratton on the phone. He said he'd come to the War Department. It took him 75 minutes to make the 10-minute drive. He sits down, looks at the Declaration of War for a long time, and the officers around him are just urging him to call Pearl Harbor. It's 12:30. The Japanese planes are on the way, but if he picked up the phone and called Pearl Harbor, our men still could have been at their guns. Instead, he said, I can't call. The Japs might have the phone lines tapped.
He
refused to use the phone or Army or Navy radio. You know how he notified Pearl Harbor? He used Western Union. He sent a telegram. It was not even marked urgent, and I'm not making this up. General Short received the message, the Western Union message, 6 hours after the attack, and 2 hours later, Admiral Kimmel got his copy. Just talk for just a moment about Marshall. This man had been dismissed by General MacArthur in peacetime because in command of a peacetime regiment, the regiment's reputation had fallen so low, but he helped out with Roosevelt's CCC, the Conservation Corps, Civilian Conservation Corps, came to the attention of Harry Hopkins, and all of a sudden he's shot above the heads of many senior officers to become chief of staff. Now, after what happened at Pearl Harbor, he should not have been trusted with any position, but in 1945 he became Truman's special envoy to China, where he enjoined truces upon Chiang Kai-shek, which freed up the communist troops to regroup, came home, became Secretary of State, as such imposed a weapons embargo against the nationalists, which ensured that the communists would win in China. In 1947, he announces the Marshall Plan, named for him, even though he had nothing to do with thinking it up. Of course, the Marshall Plan enriched U.S. multinational corporations at the expense of the U.S. taxpayers and set the ground for the European Union. Then, during the Korean War, you'll recall that General MacArthur had almost won that war. He'd pushed the communists back to the Yalu River, and all of a sudden, the Chinese started sending their troops across the Yalu. And General MacArthur ordered the bridges to be bombed, which would have won the war. But guess who's Secretary of Defense and reverses that order? George Marshall. And this is a terrible foreshadowing, of course, of the betrayal of our men in Vietnam. And I should point out that Joe McCarthy wrote a book about George Marshall. It was called America's Retreat from Victory, the story of George Catlett Marshall. And that it gives you a major reason why the establishment decided to destroy Joe McCarthy. Yeah, they didn't mind his going after minor communists in the State Department. When he attacked Marshall, he was going after one of the big boys. But let's just mention the horseback ride before the break. He was not on a horseback ride for those 2.5 hours on the morning of December the 7th. You know what he was? His cover was blown inadvertently by Arthur Upham Pope, who wrote a biography of the Soviet ambassador, Maxim Litvinov. On the morning of December the 7th, 1941, Litvinov arrived in Washington and was met at the airport by General George Marshall, who I'm sure told him not to worry, just go to the White House because you're about to be in a position to get unlimited lend-lease from the United States of America. That's where he was, meeting the Soviet ambassador instead of being at the War Department where he should have been on the morning that Pearl Harbor was about to be bombed.
Wow. Oh, what an awful thing. What a terrible thing, and they do it repeatedly. Well, as you mentioned, they did it with the Lusitania. And Churchill mentioned that when live bait is concerned, that people, if Americans are killed, then America will stand up for those that are killed. And they use that that live bait tactic every time.
Well, it happened with the Maine, it happened with Lusitania, it happened with Pearl Harbor, and it happened with 9-1-1.
Exactly.
And so this is all part of a pattern. That's what I want to make clear. This is part of a pattern. It's a continuum through history with the same forces behind it who are on their own continuum.
Absolutely. Well, fascinating information. Okay, we are coming up on our top of the hour break. We will be back at 6 minutes after the hour with our guest today. And do be sure and look for his books. His one book, his most recent one, is Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and that is at Amazon. And he's talked about that book a couple of times on our program. It's a fascinating read. Anyway, we will be back at 6 minutes after the hour.
Tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna. Our guest today is James Perloff. He is the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior. It is available at Amazon. He is also the author of The Shadows of and the American Decline, and that was written in 1988, or at least published then. He's also written some other things. And speaking of books, you mentioned just before the break, America's Retreat from Victory, and you were talking about George C. Marshall, and what an awful scoundrel he was.
Yes, and both pre- and post-Pearl Harbor, and we've been talking about pre-Pearl Harbor, so why don't we move to, we're after the top of the hour, we'll move to post-Pearl Harbor and what happened then.
Sure.
There were a number of investigations, and because it wasn't just a matter of declaring war on Japan, Congress and the American public wanted to know why we had had such a disaster. Why was the fleet caught off guard? Thousands of Americans had been killed or wounded. 18 ships, including 8 battleships, were sunk or heavily damaged. And so there was a demand for accountability. So President Roosevelt appointed a commission to investigate Pearl Harbor. It was called the Roberts Commission. It was headed by Owen Roberts, who was a Supreme Court justice, very friendly with Roosevelt. He was a big-time internationalist, made quite a few speeches talking about the need to go to war. So he was not a man who was likely to find too much wrong with Washington's pre-war attitude. Also on the commission was Major General Frank McCoy, who was a close friend of George Marshall. Also Brigadier General Joseph McNarney, who was on Marshall's staff and chosen on Marshall's recommendation. Also retired Rear Admiral Joseph Reeves, who Roosevelt had given a job in Lend-Lease, and William Stanley, who was the only member, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. I don't find much fault with him, though, because he seemed to be trying to do an honest job. But the commission conducted 3 weeks of hearings, 2 days in Washington and the rest in Hawaii. And then at the end, they issued an official report. They said that the Washington had conducted itself in a superlative manner prior to Pearl Harbor. They said all the blame was the fault of our commanders in Hawaii, namely the Pacific Fleet Commander, Admiral Husband Kimball, and the Army Commander, General Walter C. Short. It said that they had not been adequately alert, had not taken adequate surveillance measures to protect Pearl Harbor. And before the report was made public, both Stark, the Chief of Naval Operations, and General Marshall were allowed to read it and vet it. It was given to President Roosevelt. And he threw it to his secretary with a smile and said, give that to the papers for their afternoon edition. And all across the country, the words dereliction of duty were blazed on headlines. And members of Congress said these officers should be shot. They started getting death threats in the mail. And everyone in America thought it was the commanders in Pearl Harbor that were responsible for the disaster. Now, as far as surveillance goes, I'd like to point out that they had very limited surveillance capacity. I'm going to quote, Kimmel's intelligence officer, Rear Admiral Edward Layton. He said, quote, "There was never any hint in any intelligence received by the local command of any Japanese threat to Hawaii. Our air defenses were stripped on orders from the Army Chief himself," that's Marshall. "Of the 12 B-17s on the island, only six could be kept in the air by cannibalizing the others for spare parts," unquote, Rear Admiral Layton. "They didn't have adequate planes to conduct a 360-degree surveillance, Deanna. But did you know that hundreds of surveillance planes were rolling out of the factories? Do you know where they were going? They're going to Russia and to England and not to our force at Pearl Harbor. Also, here's a message that Kimmel received from Washington on December the 1st about Japan and its movements. Quote, "Major capital ship strength remains in home waters, as well as the greatest portion of the carriers," unquote. Well, six carriers are on the, a few hundred miles northeast of northwest of Pearl Harbor at this point. But they're giving no hint whatsoever that there's any threat to Pearl Harbor prior to this happening. And none of these intercepts, they don't know that the consul general there is reporting the exact locations of the ships in dock or any of this information that's been decoded or revealed through personal warnings. So Kimmel, in short, protested the Roberts Commission findings because Supreme Court Justice Roberts had run this in a very irregular and informal manner. And when Admiral Kimmel went to the hearing, he brought a fellow officer to act as his attorney, and he was denied that right. And Justice Roberts said, "Wow, this is not a trial. You're not on trial, Admiral, so there won't be any attorneys here." And testimony was taken unsworn and unrecorded, much of it. And so what Kimmel and Short really wanted was to be court-martialed, because at least in a court-martial, you could present evidence, you could question witnesses, you would operate in a standardized under standardized rules of evidence rather than the personal methods that Roberts had been using in his commission. And so they wanted trials, and Congress wanted trials too. They wanted these officers punished, but President Roosevelt said that there would be no trials until such time as public, he said, quote, "until such time as public interest and safety would permit." Now, a lot of people thought he was trying to cover up for Kimmel and Short, but no, he didn't want a trial because it would reveal the foreknowledge of Washington of the attack. Well, finally, in 1944, people in Congress were getting upset, and they mandated that the trials took place. They said, "Well, look, you know, we're winning the war now in both Europe and Asia. This public safety matter will no longer wash an excuse. We want these trials." So in 1944, the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Navy Court of Inquiry convened to investigate Pearl Harbor. At this point, Kimmel and Short had learned from fellow officers that they'd been betrayed and that Washington had foreknowledge of the attack. So at the Navy Court of Inquiry, as the admirals heard the evidence being read, as they heard the intercepts that Washington had access to, that they kept, information they had kept from Kimmel and Short, the admirals threw their pencils on the floor. They completely exonerated Admiral Kimmel and laid all blame upon Washington. The Army Pearl Harbor Board also was privy to this new information, and they reached the same conclusion. Here are the closing words of the Army Pearl Harbor Board's report. Quote, "Up to the morning of December the 7th, 1941, everything that the Japanese were planning to do was known to the United States," unquote. Now, that's official, but how do you think the public reacted to this reversal? And the answer is the public didn't react, because President Roosevelt ordered that the trial verdicts be quashed and made top secret. And the excuse he gave was that the Japanese, we couldn't let the Japanese know we had decoded their diplomatic messages, which didn't really make a lot of sense because we no longer had diplomatic relations with them anyway. So it's not like we're going to be decoding those messages now. But this would give Roosevelt time to undermine these findings. But I'm sorry, you were about to say something.
Well, it is just absolutely amazing. And, of course, if they had let it be known, they would have probably put it in a very, very small little notice on page 30 in the New York Times or something.
But it would be an impeachable offense, these findings. But as we're going to see, and I know we have a break coming up soon, the reason Roosevelt said we'll let the public know, but not at this time due to reasons of national security. In the meantime, this gave Roosevelt in time to order new investigations. The it would discredit both the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Navy Court of Inquiry.
Right.
And to run the Army investigation, because you know that President Roosevelt was a 33rd degree Mason, he,
right.
The man appointed to run that by Secretary of War Skull and Bone Stimson was Lieutenant Colonel Henry Clausen, a very high-ranking Freemason.
Right.
And on the Navy side, it was technically under an Admiral Kent Hewitt, but all the work was done by Lieutenant Commander John Sonnet. Now, I want to just point out that it was totally unprecedented for a Lieutenant Colonel and a Lieutenant Commander to do investigations that would undermine verdicts reached by generals and admirals. Unprecedented in military history, but that's what these men went about. And their goal was to get officers who had testified before the board and the Navy Court of Inquiry to now reverse their testimonies. And after the break, we'll reveal just how they did that.
Amazing. All right. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. James Perloff, and didn't the Short and Kimmel family go to court like in 1999 or go to Congress and ask that there be a reversal on the verdict, or didn't they ask Congress to
the U.S. Senate May the 25th 1999 approved a resolution that Kimmel and Short had performed their duties quote competently and professionally unquote, and that our losses at Pearl Harbor were, quote, not the result of dereliction of duty. They were denied the, oh, this is just a quote from Senator William Roth at that time, said they were denied vital intelligence that was available in Washington. Strom Thurmond called them the final victims of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But to get back to this, the Sonnet and Clausen reinvestigations, what they did was they got officers to reverse their testimonies before the findings became public. So, you have, for example, you have Colonel Rufus Bratton. He had testified before the Army Pearl Harbor Board that on December the 6th, he delivered the first 13 parts of the 14-part Declaration of War to General Marshall through his secretary and to General Garrow, who was in charge of war plans. Now, after all this time, Bratton sees a car in his rearview mirror, and it's Clausen, and Clausen flags him down on a highway in Germany and hands him affidavits from General Marshall, Marshall's secretary, and General Garrow denying that Bratton delivered this message. So
wow.
You're a colonel, right? Now it's your word against the Army Chief of Staff, so what do? He understands what he's being asked to do, and he writes out a new deposition saying he must have been mistaken, he never delivered the message. And this happened to officer after officer, but not all of them would bend. Colonel Otis Sattler of the Army Signal Corps stuck to his guns, and another one, very important witness, was Captain Lawrence Safford. He was the head of the cryptography department of the Navy. He was considered the father of naval intelligence. Congress awarded him the Legion of Merit. He developed more than 20 cryptographic devices, so he was a very eminent man. He was approached by Sonnet, the Navy investigator, and he said, I'll quote Safford, quote, "His purpose seemed to be to refute testimony before earlier investigations that was unfavorable to anyone in Washington and to beguile, quote-unquote, hostile witnesses into changing their stories." And here's some of the verbal prods that Safford recorded that Sonnet said to him. Quote, "It is very doubtful that there ever was a Wynn's message." Quote, "It is no reflection on your veracity to change your testimony." Quote, "It is no reflection on your mentality to have your memory play tricks after such a long period." Well, Savage stuck to his guns, and later before Congress he would testify, but most of the officers were bent, and they knew that they would not be promoted. So what happened was, when the United States government finally released the findings, they waited until August the 29th, 1945. That was the day that American troops arrived in Japan. All America was celebrating the end of the war. So there's a little, nobody cares that much about Pearl Harbor at this moment, right? So there's a blurb in the paper that says that, oh, the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Naval Court of Inquiry did find fault with Washington, but subsequent investigations discredited these findings and vindicated the original determination of the Roberts Commission that Kimmel and Short were guilty. And that's what the public was told, and they never found out the truth unless they happened to read some of the books that were written about Pearl Harbor afterwards.
Sure.
I'd like to mention I should probably mention that Congress got in on the act. Congress did start an investigation in November of 1945, but the odds were stacked in favor of the Roosevelt administration. Of course, Truman had taken over now, but Truman got to appoint the head to the committee because Congress was dominated by the Democrats, so they got a 6-4 majority on the investigating committee, which meant that only witnesses that the majority wanted to be called would be called. And a number of officers were ordered simply not to testify before Congress. For example, Major Warren Clear, who had warned the War Department about Pearl Harbor, was told not to appear before the committee, so he didn't. Chief Warrant Officer Ralph Briggs, who had intercepted the Winds message, which had warned of war, was told by his commanding officer not to testify. Alwin Kramer was the head of the translation section of the Navy Department. He was actually thrown into the psychiatric ward of Bethesda Naval Hospital, same place where Joe McCarthy and James Moore Forrestal met their end, to keep him from testifying before Congress. And finally, the Republicans found out about it. They got him out, but he was so intimidated before Congress, he basically just gave a very wavering testimony, yes and no, on whether or not he'd seen the intercepts. But in the end, of course, all the Democrats stuck to the party, and they were able to compromise one or two of the Republicans to join them. So the public was simply told that, you know, the Pearl Harbor Committee had vindicated the Roberts Commission and that President Roosevelt had been exonerated. But I want to talk about the promotions that went to people who were willing to play ball. Lieutenant Colonel Clausen became the Sovereign Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite in the Southern Jurisdiction.
Oh, gosh.
He became the head of Freemasonry in America, the same position Albert Pike held. Admiral Stanley, who was on the Roberts Commission, became ambassador to Russia. Rear Admiral Reeves was on the Roberts Commission. 5 months after the commission handed his report, he was promoted, even though he was retired, he was promoted to full admiral by President Roosevelt, allegedly for his services during the Spanish-American War. Get that. Brigadier General McNarney was promoted to lieutenant general, which is a big step up, and he was made general of U.S. occupation forces in Germany. General Gerald was made commander of the 15th Army. Walter Bedell Smith, who had participated in the cover-up on Marshall's staff, was made ambassador to Russia and also head of the CIA. Marshall, of course, became Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, and Cordell Hull got the Nobel Peace Prize.
Wow. But so everybody got promoted, and Short and Kimmel got scapegoated. Oh, gosh.
And all the men who testified on their behalf, Colonel Bratton, Colonel Sattler, Captain Safford, and Lieutenant Commander Kramer never went anywhere. They never got a promotion. They got no ambassadorships. Well, you know, Jesus said that, you know, they have the reward in this lifetime, right? Well, just to follow up, I'd like to mention that this is part of a pattern throughout our history. And it's interesting when we discuss Pearl Harbor. I'm sure you're familiar with this. Before 9/11, just 1 year, September 2000, the project for a new American century, which had, you know, Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and all the usual CFR Zionist types on it, did a paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And it called for increased U.S. military presence in the Middle East. They said, quote, "The transformation is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor," unquote. This has been interesting too, Diana. I was asked to review this movie when it came out. May 2001, Disney, which in recent years has been not noted for its patriotism, May 2001, just 4 months before 9/11, Disney released the movie Pearl Harbor with Ben Affleck. Very patriotic, war-rousing film that, of course, presented the standard version and showed President Roosevelt being completely surprised by the attack, despite all the information that is available. And speaking of that information, I think at this point we should probably talk about resources that are available on this.
Sure. I didn't realize that Disney put that movie out.
Yeah. Well, isn't it amazing how Hollywood does this stuff? The way they time it. You ever see the movie The Four Feathers, the British movie about the guy is accused of cowardice and then he redeems himself? The Four Feathers?
No.
It's kind of classic British movie. Well, anyway, it came out in 1939. I never thought it was a coincidence that they made that film right when Britain was about to go to war. I never really thought it was a coincidence that may not have been a coincidence that Gone with the Wind came out in 1939 on the doorstep of World War II, because, you know, there was, I think, a feeling that a lot of Southerners wouldn't want to fight under the American flag, and maybe that's why right on the doorstep of World War I, you had, what was that film with D.W. Griffith, Birth of a Nation, very pro-Southern?
Yes.
And they wanted to get the Southern boys to want to fight under the American flag again. Right at the beginning of each World War, you had these major films coming out. So I have to think that there, it may be coincidence, but
I don't believe in
too many coincidences. They happen, but not that often.
Exactly. All righty. We'll be back in 3 minutes, and you'll give us some of those that documentation. Be right back. Today is James Perloff, and he is talking about Pearl Harbor and the aftermath, and what some of the people that were sacrificed, and then some of the people that were promoted and got very lofty positions, and that's just disgusting, absolutely disgusting. But that's the way it's always been, and that's the way it is now. Okay.
That's right. You and I don't win the Pulitzer Prizes, or
you won't win
the National Radio Awards. We'll keep on fighting for what's true and what's honest and what's right. Well, I was going to mention resources for people to find out more. Like, I start with my own book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, because the book begins, the first chapter is called Six Wars, and it deals with the false flags that brought us into six different wars, starting with Pearl Harbor. I have also written several articles for the New American on Pearl Harbor. And if you just Google Perloff and Pearl Harbor, those articles should pop up. The most significant one from 2001 was called Pearl Harbor, Hawaii was surprised, Washington was not. But to get away from myself, some books I would recommend would be Infamy by John Toland, Pulitzer Prize winner, which reveals most of these same facts. Robert Stennett's book, Day of the Deceit, which focuses on the naval intercepts. And if people would like to watch something on YouTube, in the 1980s, the BBC mentioned before this documentary, Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor. You can watch that in full on YouTube. There are some other excellent books that appeared over the years. In 1947, George Morgenstern, who was a Chicago Tribune reporter, published a very thorough book called Pearl Harbor. And even though he didn't have access to some of the testimonies I've given, his summary of the facts was very thorough. Rear Admiral Robert Theobald wrote the book The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor, published in 1954. He was in Pearl Harbor on that day commanding destroyers. And, of course, Admiral Kimmel himself told his story in his book, Admiral Kimmel's Story. And those, all of them, those books are available one way or another through used bookstores, or many of them are still in print, such as Day of Deceit and Infamy. But I should mention something here, talking about alternative media. It's interesting, I find, that Admiral Kimmel, to tell his story of Pearl Harbor, had to go to the same small publishing house that Rear Admiral Theobald had to go to. That was the Devon Adair House in Connecticut. Isn't it interesting? You think, you know, the mass media would just be itching to big publishers. One, he's the guy who was the commander at Pearl Harbor, right? Commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet. Wouldn't the Doubleday and the big publishers take it? No. He had to go to a small publishing house. His book did not become a book of the month selection, you know. He didn't get reviews. So people, by and large, didn't know these books were even out there, but they're out there. But people have to look. You know, they say, the Bible says, knock and you shall ask. Well, sometimes that's true for understanding history. You have to look, because the mass media, CNN and New York Times, are not going to hand it. You have to look beyond for the truth. It's interesting that in every era, whether it's World War One or World War Two, there are men like Captain Safford and Admiral Kimmel who stood up for the truth and told the truth. You just have to look for it. It is out there.
Right. There's another book that I recently read called Bankrupting the Enemy by Edward S. Miller. And it talks about what the government, the U.S. government did to Japan, a very detailed book, how they attempted to really bankrupt them, so that they would respond in the way that they want, that the U.S. government wanted them to respond. We do have a bunch of callers. Why don't we take some calls?
Absolutely.
All righty, let's take Wes in Idaho. Wes, welcome to the program.
Hello, Deanna. Pretty
Hi.
Good, pretty good line there, live bait tactic. For the guest, did he have an explanation as to why the Japanese didn't hit the fuel tanks or the dry docks?
Yeah, it was a mistake. If they'd been better in their planning, they would have hit the fuel tanks. Because they didn't, Pearl Harbor still had a good fuel supply, and ships were still able to operate out of there. But had they hit the fuel tanks, instead they concentrated more on the glory of attacking the battleships. But they could have planned it better. But there was just a strategic mistake on their part.
Good. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you, Wes. All right, let's take Robert in Missouri. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just came in towards the end when you were talking about Project for a New American Century and with 9/11. And the thing was, I wanted to get in real quick. Have you either one of you looked into predictive programming in 9/11?
Meaning things in the media that forecast 9/11 before it happened?
Yes, yes.
I've never done that in an organized way. We were just commenting on the fact that Disney released Pearl Harbor just a few months before 9/11 and right after the Project for the New American Century called for a new Pearl Harbor, and it seemed to correlate. But have you done some investigation that has shown other things that predicted 9/11?
Yes. You can just YouTube this stuff, and then you can, like, Google image this stuff. But anyway, let's say Terminator 2, they're going under a tunnel, caution, 9/11. Neo's passport in The Matrix, Keanu Reeves' character, his passport expires 9/11/2001. There's a bunch of these occurrences all throughout Hollywood predicting 9/11. You can watch some YouTube videos. Just type in 9/11 predictive programming, and it'll blow you away. I mean, it's statistically impossible for this to have occurred. So I would encourage all the listeners and both of you guys to get into this. It will blow your mind. So I'm going to go ahead and hang up, though.
All righty. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks very much. I hadn't heard of that. You know, Dan, and one reason I'm not alert to a lot of things Hollywood does these days, I just can't stand the movies coming out of Hollywood.
I hardly ever go to the movie. Yeah, it's just so much garbage and sex and violence and trash. All righty, let's take Dan in Oregon. Dan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for accepting the call, and I really have just the one question for James. The personal lives of the victims of the Pearl Harbor, as the admirals and the captains and so forth, that were hit by the system, if you will. How do they handle their personal lives after Pearl Harbor? I mean, did they become alcoholics? They went crazy or whatever? I could never figure out how they coped with handling being, you know, trampled. That's the end of my question.
I don't have that much information on it. I know that Captain Safford, the father of cryptography in the Navy Department, spent much of his life trying to prove the truth of Pearl Harbor. And I read, and this is not a quote, it's just a generalization, but his wife, I think it was said to him, Pearl Harbor, I never heard another word about Pearl Harbor. So I think that his wife felt he'd become obsessed with it, and he probably had some marital strain as a result of that. I think that those men who stuck up for the truth probably understood that their own personal honor and their commitment to integrity was more important than promotion. If they had not, they would have reversed their testimonies and played ball. So I think that most of these men, they probably suffered in terms of finance and position, but I think in terms of their personal self-satisfaction and that they had done the right thing, they were okay with it. I know that they said that Admiral Kimmel was a fighter to the end. And, of course, his family supported him all the way, and he fought for many years to prove the truth. So I think that having the ambition to do the right thing and tell the truth probably gave these men a great will in terms of survival, as opposed to, I've never heard of anyone descending into alcoholism, but I haven't really investigated a lot of these minor officers and what happened in their post-war lives.
All righty. Right. I would think that that would be such a difficult thing to live with, particularly since the newspaper just so vilified them.
Right.
And how do you have a personal life when everybody around you thinks that you're a villain? I mean, that's how do you deal with that? That would be very, very hard to do. But apparently they have the integrity and the stamina to continue to fight, as you say.
It's very difficult. And I should mention that even the Republican senators who are in their minority on the Congressional Investigating Committee that began in 1945, they were tarred and feathered in the newspapers as being pro-Nazi, pro-Japanese, trying to soil the reputation of the late President Roosevelt. It's very difficult. But you know what? I think that that kind of attack is easier to deal with, I would think more easy to deal with than the guilt of knowing of the orphans and widows that you had left behind if you were General Marshall. So I think that that kind of pressure is not as bad as the pressure of guilt and really sin that was committed by these high officials who had foreknowledge of the attack and would not share it. I should mention another anecdote maybe that we didn't cover today. If you watch that documentary, The Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor, you'll find it documented elsewhere as well. Cordell Hull met with an old member of the...
Hold that thought, and we'll pick it up on the other side of the break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Our guest today, James Perloff. And Jim, you were going to talk about the sacrifice at Pearl Harbor, and then we have a couple more callers online.
Okay. Well, I'll try to be quick. One thing I should just mention before the show runs out, we'll have an article on Pearl Harbor at Henry Macko's site, you know, M-A-K-O-W. I write from him time to time. It'll be just an abbreviated version, but that article, which will appear on his website tomorrow around noontime, should be tomorrow or maybe the next day at the latest, we'll have hyperlinks to these various resources that I've been talking about. But just to continue with the story, Secretary of State Cordell Hull met secretly on a park bench shortly before Pearl Harbor with a newspaper man named Joseph Lieb. He'd worked in the FDR administration, and Hull thought he could trust him. And he showed him some of the Japanese intercepts, and he said, please try to get this into the hands of the newspapers. Maybe the attack can be averted because his heart was not in it. But he said, keep my name out of it. You can't reveal where you got these. So Joseph Lieb ran to the office of Lyle Wilson, his friend, who is the Washington Bureau Chief of United Press, UPI, right? And Lyle Wilson just looked at him and just laughed, and he said the whole story was ridiculous. And after Pearl Harbor, Lyle Wilson called Joseph Lieb back to his office, and he showed him Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech, and the two men just wept. It was too late, and there was nothing they could do about it. But you will see Joseph Lieb interviewed in that same BBC documentary, Sacrifice at Pearl Harbor.
All righty. Thank you. Let's take Jerry in Chicago. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, both of you. I just wanted to find out one or two things. Were you on Rick Adams' show like maybe 8-9 months ago discussing the same thing?
No, I wish I was. I'm always eager to go on new shows. If Rick Adams will invite me on, I'd love to go on.
Okay, because somebody was, I think it was the grandson of, what was the guy's name that was in charge of the Pacific Fleet over there
Kimmel,
in Pearl
the Kimmel,
Harbor?
Probably the Kimmel family, yes. The Kimmel family has been fighting for the exoneration of Admiral Kimmel for a long time.
Okay, then that was the show I heard. Hey, I happen to have my local congressman, my district congressman, Dan Lipinski, is going to be speaking at a VFW hall in Oak Lawn here in December 10th. And I wanted to go in there and just ask him one or two questions, because it seems to me like all of these wars, 30 years, 50 years in the future, we find out that, oh, it was a mistake, like the USS Mannix in 1964 in Vietnam, the USS Liberty, well, that didn't... Yeah, you know, same thing with Pearl Harbor, and the same thing with the sinking of Lusitania, the War of 1812 with the USS Maine, all of this stuff. It seems that later on, and 9/11 and weapons of mass destruction, it goes on and on and on.
That's why people don't get too excited when they hear about chemical weapons in Syria, because we've heard this story so many times, and so many times the story we were told up front turned out not to be true.
Yeah, but again, we have 450 people that are running this country speaking for 318 million, and they're just not listening to what the people are saying, and they're going ahead and doing their dastardly deeds anyway.
That's right, because they've got the major media on their side, they've got the microphone, and thus are able to influence and sway the majority of public opinion. But Deanna and I are hoping that the factor of truth will weigh in the balance greater than the factor of money, which they have on their side.
No, I agree with you, but like I said, I'm looking for a stumper that I can ask Lipinski that these other veterans that are going to be there, I'm sure, because it's a VFW hall, and I didn't serve, so I really have no right in being there, but I just want to stump him with a question to where everybody will be questioning, hey, yeah, answer his question, more or less.
Yeah, well, the questions you raised about the fact that after the fact we learn about the Maine, the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, and Tonkin Gulf, and 9-1-1, just presenting those and say, well, what does that say about America and how we're being run would be a very good question to put to him.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You two have a great day. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you.
All righty, let's take Fred in Michigan. Fred, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna. And
hi.
And the last caller said he doesn't really have a right to be at VFW. Well,
I think everybody has a right to ask the congresspeople some questions. Absolutely.
And not only that, I would encourage him, if the spirit moves him to do this, locally find a radio station or public access through the local Comcast and establish a broadcast program for veterans' concerns, and we can integrate everything into that format of program, just like you do. Okay, so James Forrestal, what shall we say, the mysterious murder of James Forrestal, and if you could, Jim, there's a paradox that's most perplexing to me. My buddy ACH, in his book Synagogue of Satan, chronicles the fact that Uncle Adolf had extricated all of the satanic Talmudic Zionist gangsters from the government and began printing Germany's national currency, etc. I'm supposed to believe that the Wall Street gangster banksters through Brown Brothers Harriman, Prescott Bush, you know, Rockefeller, funded Hitler's, quote, war machine. I find it perplexing that Uncle Adolf would bring back in Jewish gangster banksters to fund his government operations when he just got rid of them all. I mean,
well, that's a good point, but we are talking about Pearl Harbor. Do you have something, about
Pearl
Harbor?
Yeah, well, James Forrestal, wasn't he the Secretary with Nate?
Secretary of Defense.
Okay, and after the war, wasn't he murdered?
He died under very suspicious circumstances. He fell from a window on the 16th floor of Bethesda Naval Hospital, May the 22nd, 1949. On the internet, there's material on that. There was also a book published in 1966 by Cornell Simpson called The Death of James Forrestal. And he had come very much in conflict with the Truman administration's policies, become very critical of them, and his death was called a suicide officially, but many people think that it was his criticism of American foreign policy and his revulsion at what was happening that led to his death.
And didn't the newspaper really make him look very foolish because of his questioning and his skepticism?
Oh, they tried to look up paranoiac, sure.
Right,
the usual smear job.
Right.
And then there was another guy, Olson, wasn't there? That was after Forrestal, but there was another guy, Olson. I don't know if he was in the cabinet.
I think that there was the name Olson does somehow link into the Forrestal's death, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Well, Israeli Mossad CIA operations, I'm sure, as it is to this very day, with 9/11 and everything like that. So the new Pearl Harbor, well, what can I say?
Yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
It is a continuum.
Right, yes. He did bring up that book, The New Pearl Harbor, which it certainly was. 9/11 was certainly another Pearl Harbor.
Right, and again, the book that I have out, Deanna, I should mention, Truth is the Lonely Warrior, does begin. It starts out in its first pages, of course, as you know, with Pearl Harbor. The first chapter is devoted to false flags, but through about 30 chapters and appendices, it draws the very relatively, as best as I could do, a complete picture of the whole satanic establishment that we've been talking about to try to give people a full picture. And that book is, by the way, available both now in Kindle and paperbound, and can also be had through your local bookstore. Again, it's Truth is a Lonely Warrior.
Indeed. Well, thank you so very much for compiling all this information about Pearl Harbor. It is an interesting study, and certainly people should know about it. And I think, too, people say, well, why drag the past up? Why go back? Why? But it's imperative that people do this, don't you think?
The past is so relevant. It's been said so many times wisely that if we don't learn from history's mistakes, we'll repeat them. And we've repeated history's mistakes over and over again because we didn't learn. That's why we need to keep bringing the past to people's attention.
Exactly. And you do a really good job at that. I sure appreciate it.
And
very
I sure appreciate
much.
your letting me on to air these facts. And I just want to thank you so much, Deanna. You have a fantastic guest. I've seen your guest list. And anybody listening to your show is going to come out really well informed.
Oh, thank you so much.
Wish you were the anchor woman on CNN.
I'm sure I'll get the job any minute. All righty, take care.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.